I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show this week, the BBC have a new chair and a new licence fee settlement. Our panel discuss what it all means. Also on the programme, how did they make Planet Earth 3? The creative director of the Beeb's Natural History Unit takes on a Wildlife 101. All that plus Spotify making big cuts, the Premier League bounces back, and in the media quiz, we discover who's been foiled by Fleet Street. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, BT have announced a partnership with Apple TV to produce an EE TV app with live streaming and on-demand content, a custom EE branded remote, including TV guide button and automatic setup for the Apple TV box. It's the first deal of its kind in the UK. Claudia Winkleman is leaving her Radio 2 show. The broadcaster's departure is one of many changes to the station this year. Ramesh Ranganathan will join in April, saying, "I'm grateful to Claude for wanting to spend more time with her kids and enabling me to spend less time with mine." And Carol Vorderman has snubbed an offer from GB News. A well-placed source told The Mirror that Carol wouldn't touch GB News with a barge pole. Now, joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we welcome back Adam Bowie. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
Thank you. You like stats. What is your favourite stat of this week?
4%, and we'll come to it later on.
Oh, good tease, good tease. And I was doing a thing today that I think you were watching. Tell everyone about it.
Yeah, it's called Sounds Amazing, and it's a one-day sort of now virtual event that the BBC put on each year. It's all about sound, as the name gives away, and I think it'll all be online at some point. But yeah, it's lots of people talking about different elements of sound. You were talking about AI and sound, but we had people from the film and TV world talking about sound. So an amazing guy who did the sound for Paddington and has done it for Wonka, coming out I believe this week, and an amazing woman as well who did the sound on things like SAS Rogue Heroes, a Stephen Knight drama from BBC, and working in 50 degree heat, talking about working in 50 degree heat where none of the recorders are made to work
yes.
at those kind of temperatures. And if you get sand in them, they'll just break. So really good. And yeah, if you're interested in sound, it's worth checking out.
Keep an eye on that, I think, from the BBC Academy. And then next to Adam, we have Broadcast Magazine's Rebecca Cooney. Hello.
Hello.
And you've been talking to all the people from Bad Wolf, the Doctor Who production company.
I have indeed, yes. Ahead of the kind of the release of the specials, I spoke to Jane Tranter and Julie Gardner and Russell T Davies. And I mean, I'm a massive Doctor Who fan. So like technically it was work. But no, I did get to geek out quite a lot. And they just seem incredibly excited to sort of be back at the helm of it, because obviously Julie Gardner, Jane Tranter, Russ T Davies were kind of the team that bought it back in 2005.
They sort of did the main reboot, didn't they?
Yes, yeah. So Jane Gardner kind of commissioned it. Julie Tranter was the head of drama at BBC Wales, I believe, at the time. And then they've gone off and made their own company. And now they're kind of, yeah, they've sort of taken over it with this deal with Disney.
Yeah, imbued with Disney cash.
Yes, very much. It's very visible on screen, isn't it? It's just, so like in the latest episode, there's this kind of great big long spaceship and they need to get along it. And kind of this little vehicle appears, and I think in the old days it would have been a golf cart, but now it floats and you can see it floating. So yeah, you can see where the money's gone into these special effects.
Adam, you've got to spend the cash on these things now, haven't you?
You do. Audiences just expect it. You know, we live in a world where you've got Game of Thrones, you've got the kind of science fiction that Apple do, which all look incredible, and audiences, and obviously Marvel, and audiences just you know, don't expect just because it's one broadcast or another that things should look different. So it's brilliant that they've got that cash.
The people spending that money often are the BBC. And there's always news. There's always BBC news here on the Media Podcast because there's a new BBC chair and it's Sameer Shah. What do we know about Sameer?
So Sameer is very much a TV man. So he has run for many years a production company called Juniper, which they've made kind of shows for a range of channels over a range of years. I think kind of probably one of the most recent ones was This Week, which was the sort of long-running Andrew Neil show. So yeah, he is from a television background, which I think is going to be really interesting just because kind of, you know, these people, you know, chairs of BBC, it tends to be kind of, you know, somebody from the Treasury or sort of a money person or a kind of public policy person. So to have somebody with a TV background at a time when we've got a real kind of sort of commissioning slowdown within the TV industry and the TV industry is in real panic, I think is going to be, like, I think really helpful. And there's going to be just a sort of a different level of insight going on there.
I mean, Adam, normally it's a political appointee. Well, this is still a political appointee, but they don't always have a great connection to broadcasting.
No, they might have come from banking in the past, for example. I think that will be welcomed. Obviously,
yeah, so what has media been sort of saying about it?
I think it's been pretty positive. I mean, you've certainly seen people like Andrew Neil, obviously, who knows him. But, you know, a number of people, because he's, you know, he has worked at LWT before. He did a stint for, I think, the BBC Politics unit down at Milbank in the past. So I think it's got to be formalised. So we've got there's an acting chair at the moment, and it will happen at some point in the new year, I guess.
Hey, Rebecca, more pressing for the broadcaster is Thursday's licence fee settlement, which has popped a tenner on, I think,
yes,
up about 6% to £169.50, so still below inflation. BBC don't seem entirely happy with that, do they?
Not overjoyed, no. So basically a couple of years ago, the government said we're going to freeze the licence fee for a couple of years and then we'll raise it in line with inflation. So in line with inflation, as it was, as they were measuring, it would have been, as you said, about 9%, and that would have added about 15 quid onto it. They kind of sort of started making noises like, no, we're not going to do that. They've then come back and said, we are going to raise it in line with inflation, but it seems to be the way they're measuring inflation, they're calling it 6.7%, I believe. So
yes, it's which month you pick.
You decide when the inflation comes from. So, I mean, what that means, like my colleague Ellie Khan, who sort of covered this, sort of sat down and worked out today, that's about a £400 million shortfall in what they were expecting. Yes. And that is, yeah, that's you know, it sounds like kind of a small amount of money to the BBC, and you know, the government is arguing this is a cost of living thing, but at the same time, that is a huge, huge kind of, you know, not, I wouldn't say hole in the budget because they haven't had the money, but it's kind of, it is a drop from what they were expecting, and perhaps, you know, it is a real terms cut, effectively.
I mean, also, we're definitely in the realm now of content being cut. We've already seen it, things like the news channels being combined, Newsnight going. I mean, you've got to take the money off the screen, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the slight problem is that we do kind of expect the moon on a stick from the BBC, right? We want it to be doing all these amazing things. And when it doesn't, or when it gets things wrong, you know, rightly, we give it a hard time. But I think, you know, you are going to have to pay for some of that. And I think it is a really, really tricky one for the BBC to navigate. And they have kind of said in sort of a, you know, the most kind of downbeat or like sort of measured way they could, yeah, this is going to cost us. You're going to see this on screen. There will be cuts.
Well, speaking money in the media, over to Spotify now, whose love of podcasts is somewhat being tested by a sizable round of layoffs and the axing of two prestige series, Heavyweight and Stolen. Adam, these were two Gimlet shows, which was part of like a kind of the deal that sort of kicked off the sort of podcasting resurgence, podcasting boom. US audio makers are not happy.
Yeah, they're not. I mean, these are prestigious shows and, you know, winning, you know, Peabody's and Pulitzer Prizes. So we're talking quite serious kind of things. I think the Gimlet purchase doesn't seem to have gone particularly well, I think, all things told. I remember at the time everyone considered it like you're buying your HBO, you're the HBO in that. But if you look at what's happened with various things to various shows over the years, that it really doesn't seem to have gone that way. And what it feels like is that from a Spotify's perspective, that the hosts in a studio where it's a bit more known, the costs are probably fairly flat. They might be really big. You're paying Joe Rogan, for example, a lot of money, but you kind of know where you are, you know how many staff there are, and of course those kind of shows just do extraordinarily well for them. So it feels like, you know, the sort of prestigious ones, and you know, if we've heard the kind of credits, when you hear the number of names on it and you realize the number of people, because the amount of time it takes to make those kind of things, feels like Spotify's falling a little bit out of love with that kind of.
I saw someone describe the podcasting scene in a slightly different way, which I hadn't necessarily picked up on before, where they're sort of journalistic podcasts and then the sort of more entertainment chat casts. And as you were saying, the economics of those is staunchly different, aren't they? And the person was basically saying that they didn't think that Spotify could understand the journalistic elements of the business. All tech companies have trouble with media.
Yes, I think that's fair. And again, it's that kind of wanting a return on investment, when actually maybe there is a good story here and you need to put the time and the effort in to find it. Maybe there isn't one. I definitely have heard some podcasts. There was a BBC one about a body they found in Norway somewhere, and they were trying to identify this woman who she was found in the 50s, and she was probably a spy, but they know nothing about her. And they kind of got to the end of the podcast and went, yeah, we still don't know anything about her. And that could have been, and you do with those kind of investigative podcasts, sometimes you get the amazing ones where they're like, there was a clear miscarriage of justice, or we're going to change the law, or there's this amazing story that emerges. And sometimes you just don't. I was thinking about this in relation to the Newsnight stuff as well, that's been cut. And I always used to think, oh, well, maybe audio is going to be the next space for that to happen. And it seems like, okay, maybe not. And I think it is just that thing of, it's really hard to go to somebody and go, can you pay me to just maybe have something really good, maybe.
Well, at the beginning, CPMs were very good. So the amount of money you'd get for 1,000 downloads was pretty high. That's dropped back a bit. The cost of acquiring new listeners is more expensive now. So suddenly the economics shift. Do you think there is a model for 8-episode runs of these things? Or did they maybe get a little bit away with themselves with free cash, or just a bit of too much excitement?
I mean, undoubtedly, look, they built up the market. They spent a lot of money. They spent a lot of money on big names as well. And, you know, that a lot of those haven't paid off, or paid off much less. And in general terms, that's probably disappearing. I think there undoubtedly is. I mean, a lot of those shows do hit the mark. I mean, investigative work always costs, I think, in television, I think in newspapers. You know, you might spend months doing something and then it goes nowhere and you can't use it and there's nothing to show for it. And I think that that's always been the case, which is why relatively few people do that really well. But the short form, I think, you know, certainly if you look at what BBC is doing, what others are doing, is it's more about putting lots of short forms into one feed so that, you know, you put your true crime investigative pieces and you have, you know, have a set of 8 or a set of 10, and then you do another set of 8 or 10.
And that means that those subscribers, when they get the show, whether they listen to it or not, so there's adverts in there which are counted, rather than starting from zero again, trying to build up a feed from nothing.
You don't have to build, you know, getting people to find and discover your podcast from scratch, because, you know, undoubtedly, you know, however many millions of podcasts were released this week or whatever, you know, that's always been the hard part.
Moving on to the Premier League, there's a new British TV deal with Sky and TNT Sports sharing the rights. Rebecca, it's worth £6.7 billion over 4 years, which is a 4% increase. Is it good? Is that good?
Well, it sounds good. It looks good on paper. But then actually some of my colleagues at Global Data did some sort of digging into it. And what they were saying was, well, actually, it's a bigger number. It's gone up from what it was, but that's also more matches for it. So on a kind of per match basis, actually the Premier League is not getting as good a return for what they're selling here. So it's perhaps not as shiny a deal as it looks.
Adam, by reading your blog, there is clearly nothing you like more than, maybe even more than Rajar, of analysing a rights deal for the Premiership.
Yeah, it is interesting. Absolutely right that they can put a positive spin, 4%, as I mentioned. But at the same time, if you look at it on a per game basis, it's gone down. I think there's a few interesting things here. One, it's a 4-year deal, and it's got, the Premier League has traditionally done 3-year deals for quite a long time now. They're saying that's what the broadcasters were asking for that.
Have they just realised it's peaked?
I think it's difficult to say. I think you run into issues. You're potentially much more market focused at any given point. You know, it feels like it comes round maybe just too frequently. If you compare and contrast with America, where they'll do 10-year deals quite frequently, and some of the NFL deals running into the late 2020s and into the early 2030s, which I'm sure they'd love. Although then you run into things like, you know, the NBA at the moment, which is going to be the next big sports rights. You know, they're looking to double because it's been such a long time.
And it's kind of the only thing on television that rates in America.
Yeah, I mean, sport is just incredible for them. But I think the interesting thing here is there's no Amazon now as part of this deal. And indeed, there's no new entrants. You know, we're back to Sky with most of it, and then TNT, which of course was BT before, having one package, a decent-ish package. But, you know, Sky undoubtedly is the big winner here. And even though a lot of new entrants were rumoured, you know, Dazen, I think, yeah, they were definitely, and I'm sure they bid, but obviously not high enough. And, you know, the Premier League in the past, they carved out a deal which they thought would have been good for the streamers. I myself, I always found that a bit weird because Amazon, right, this week as we speak, Amazon are broadcasting the first of their two sets of rounds of the Premier League, and they burn through them all in December.
Yes, they sort of get Christmas rights.
Yeah, like and then it's gone, and they will be back. They've still got one more year of that. Whereas actually, I think the way Amazon has gone, they've actually got one Champions League game a week from next season, and that will obviously last, you know, a good chunk of the year, which, you know, means that you're going to come back and know to come back, whereas Amazon actually has to do quite a lot of marketing for a short period of time. Part of them would have loved an Apple or a YouTube
because
or someone's
in
a
other
bit.
Markets, Apple are in Major League Baseball, aren't they? And that's in the UK too. YouTube do sports in the US. Disney did cricket in India. They're kind of out of that deal now. So the other streamers have played about with this, haven't they?
They have. I think the thing is, I think a lot of people think, oh, they've just got loads of money and that we can just get them to bid up. And I think, you know, if you're, you know, Google or whatever, you know, we don't need to spend stupid money. Also, you look at someone like Apple. I mean, Apple have, and they're probably their biggest deal, you know, in terms of ownership of the sport, is MLS in America, so the soccer in America, where they own everything. And actually, they then sub-license some of the games to other broadcasters so that you can at least discover it and occasionally see a Messi game before you have to come back to Apple to see all the rest of them. It's interesting, they tried to do a college football deal with Apple as well in America, and that fell through because Apple was incredibly demanding about what it wants. So I don't think a handful of games would have been enough. Apple would have basically wanted to own the Premier League in Britain. And I'm not even sure that that would have been necessarily good for the Premier League. It's one thing if you're an up-and-coming league, like Major League Soccer is in the US, but, you know, at the end of the day, they want to be in the kind of homes that already get Sky and TNT.
Well, Rebecca, Netflix have talked a lot about Live, haven't they? Or they're adding a kind of pro-celebrity golf tournament. They sort of haven't really wanted to play in the sports field otherwise, have they?
No, exactly. And I was in Content London last week, and Brandon Rigg, who's like one of the head honchos for Factual at Netflix, was sort of pointing to these exhibition matches they've been doing, the golf things, and sort of saying, no, that's been really successful for us. But yeah, it just didn't seem to have that appetite for, oh, let's go and do kind of, the sort of, let's look into the Premier League matches or the live sport in quite the same way. It was more of a, let's do it in these kind of controlled environments where we can sort of do our thing, but we don't really need to kind of get involved with the sports leagues in the same way, which I thought was quite interesting. The one thing that he was saying was, oh, actually, what we'd like is like a shiny floor sort of live talent show type thing, like Britain's Got, like with a voting element on Netflix. And it's kind of, and they're saying they've got the capacity to do that, but they just haven't found sort of the right show or the right mechanics or like the right kind of, you know, and they sort of were kind of saying, pitch us your ideas, which I was like, I don't know how that would work.
Squid Game on ice.
Yeah,
maybe that's the way to do it.
Oh God.
Just on sports. So I've been reading, so I'm not that interested in sport, it's not really my thing, but I have been reading Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN. Have either of you read this or seen it?
I'm aware of it, I haven't read it.
Yeah, so it's like an oral history of ESPN. And if you're interested in television and the evolution of television, and also obviously sports rights, it's a great story, it's kind of a mad story. It's a really thick book. But yes, Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN. And we'll be back with more media news after this.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away.
Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Now for our deep dive interview, Mike Gunton is the creative director of the BBC's Natural History Unit and responsible for Planet Earth 3, presented by David Attenborough. Based in Bristol, I spoke to him earlier today about the making of this latest series, the role the podcast plays in shaping attitudes to climate change, and Attenborough's extraordinary legacy. Here's Mike.
The brand, if you like, Planet Earth, has been going for 20 years, so, and the cycle has gone a bit quicker. The gap between the first and the second was about 10 years, and now it's shrunk down to about 6 years. So I didn't have very long to plan for this one, in fact. And funny enough, I don't know if you've heard the story, but we were very fortunate to win a BAFTA for Planet Earth 2. And when you come off the stage grasping your statuette, they whisk you behind and you speak to the press. And I thought they were going to ask me about the series and all this. And the first question they all said, when is Planet Earth 3? So I felt, right, I better get on with it, because if they're thinking that. So I literally went back to my seat in the auditorium at the, I can't remember what the event was now, but anyway, and all I had in my pocket was a business card and a pen, and I scribbled quickly down on the back of it, what would it be, what episodes, what it is. And one of the things I did remember writing is, it's got to be about humans, it's got to take a human perspective. So that kind of was that was effectively the template for what we did. And actually, because Planet Earth 2 did make such an impact, I think the commissioners and the market said, yes, we want another one quick. So yeah, we went straight into effectively thinking pre-production almost immediately after Planet Earth 2 went out. And here we are, 5.5 years later, it's on air. So there was a little bit of gap. Inevitably, of course, you've got to go through the process of raising the funding and actually convincing people it really is not just what's written on the back of a business card, a bit more than that. And then, of course, the research for a new series, I mean, that always takes at least a year, and probably took us a bit longer, probably took about 18 months to get all the new stories.
I mean, how much of it is sort of pre-planned in, you know, the sort of direction of the stories? Is it a bit like a constructed reality TV series, or is it almost like pure reality and it's what's filmed?
There's a bit of that. I mean, I think I've thought about this quite a lot and been asked quite a lot about what it is. It is almost a unique genre. I don't think there's anything quite like a landmark natural history show. The format of the sort of quasi episodic nature within a meta episode. I mean, it was kind of invented by David Attenborough when he did Life on Earth, you know, 50 years ago, and we're only really fiddling around the edges, really, from that format. But it is a strange combination of observed yet intense storytelling. There's a dramatic form to it, yet it's documentary. It is unique. It's a bit of black magic, actually. Dark arts. You know, when people come and dig deep about what we do, they kind of don't really understand, because it appears we just wander out into the wilderness with a camera, switch it on, an hour later switch it off and transmit it. And of course, it couldn't be further from that.
And I suppose when you're filming material, is there a huge amount just that sits on the cutting room floor? Is there a version A and a version B of Planet Earth 3 that could have gone out?
The best version is, I hope, the one, of course, that we transmit. It goes back to your earlier question about what is it like a constructed reality. When you go on location for a particular story, you have an overarching theme. And in Planet Earth, it's effectively about a habitat and the challenges that habitat imposes on the life that lives in that habitat, and how different animals and plants and the rest, how they've adapted in their own unique way to overcome those. And that's sometimes contextualized by what happens in the environment itself. because it is about planet Earth. So the Earth itself is a part of the story. But when you're going out to film that story, you have in your mind a clear overarching narrative of why that animal's story is relevant to this bigger theme. But what actually happens on location is determined by Mother Nature herself. And so actually, rather like doing an observational documentary, you know, you've got maybe eight characters in an obs doc, and as you start filming them, two or three, four by the wayside, one becomes more interesting than you expected. Same thing happens on location. You know, the stories develop as you're on location, and you have to have your wits about you, say, well, where is this going? That's the animal that's going to be the one that's going to do the interesting thing. So yes, there's a lot on the cutting room floor in the sense that there will be stuff about another character, another individual, or another part of that story that you in the end decide that's not as interesting or just isn't time to tell. And that, I mean, to be honest, that's one of the hardest things. If things go well, you come back with a real rich range of material. Sometimes it's quite hard to decide which is the bit of it that you want to focus on. And that partly depends on what else you've got in some of the other stories, because you're trying to create a kind of mosaic of types of story within your film. You can imagine as kind of checkerboard of things you need to tick off, and you can't have everything, but like a little bit like one of those puzzles where you move it around, eventually they all click into the right place. You go, yes, that's the picture we want to tell, and that becomes the episode.
And I guess another character in the piece is David Attenborough himself. And I think he's someone that you worked with back in 87 on what was probably, I think, going to be one of his last projects, but he seems to have marched on.
Yes. Well, I started in 1987. I was still in my 20s. And he'd done Life on Earth, which was about effectively evolution. He'd done Living Planet, which is effectively about ecology. And then he wanted to do his third one of the kind of, I suppose, the pantheon or the three sort of tenets of natural history. He wanted to do about animal behavior, ethology, as he called it. And that was Trials of Life. And so I was fortunate enough to get to work on that. And I remember my first meeting in the Natural History, and they got everybody together and said, yes, we're just about to embark on this series. Well, by the way, we've got a new director in, Mike Gunton. Here he is. Welcome. Oh, and by the way, everybody, this is David's last series. So we need to be thinking about who's going to take over. Well, that, as I say, is 34 years ago. And people have been asking and saying that ever since. And, you know, people said, well, is he going to do Planet Earth 2? And I said, well, he certainly isn't at the moment. And then, surely he's not going to do Planet Earth 3. Yes, he's going to do Planet Earth 3. I mean, I suspect I won't be doing Planet Earth 4, but I wouldn't want to put any money on him not doing Planet Earth 4 if and when it should happen. I mean, effectively, he is the DNA of Planet Earth, and the DNA of all these big statement natural histories. But I think he's become now as kind of connected with Planet Earth as he was with his own authored series, which of course the ones he did in the 70s and 80s, the Life Ofs, as they were called, you know. So no, it's been brilliant working with him, of course.
I mean, his role, as you were saying there, has sort of changed over the years to being kind of very sort of in the center of it and now leading the narration. Obviously, he's usually trusted by the audience. But he has a unique background because he was a channel controller himself. He was a program maker. So what's his take on what you're all now doing sort of for him or with him?
Well, he has got a remarkable sense of television. I mean, he has done virtually everything it is possible to do in television. He's run studios, he's been a sound recordist, he's done dramas, he's done sport. You know, he has done television, and he still has a remarkable sense of audience and what makes strong television. And I have lots of conversations with him about the direction in which we're taking things, whether he thinks it's a good idea, where the pitfalls might be. And his advice is always very sage and very, you know, I listen to it a lot. And his endorsement of what we're doing, I think for me is really critical, because it's a bit like handing your homework in or taking something home to your parents. You know, I've just done this sequence of this. What do you think? And you think, please. And he says, hopefully, amazing, never seen that before, that's remarkable. And then you think, well, if he thinks that, and if he gives it that kind of kite mark, you're pretty sure that you're onto something that's going to be a success for the audience. Well, he not only because he's seen everything, but also because, as I say, he has this fantastic calibration of what works for a TV audience, even at 97, you know, it's remarkable.
Well, if we were thinking about a Planet Earth 4, whether that's him being involved or not, what's the special sauce in a narrator or kind of a participant in this way? What does someone need to have?
Well, I'm slightly going against what I said, because, of course, there can never be another David Attenborough, and that's a pointless opportunity. But actually, what you need is another David Attenborough. But, of course, it's a mass of things. But fundamentally, it is that extraordinary integrity and intensity about knowing what it is about the natural world that is remarkable and what audiences will find remarkable, and reflecting the curiosity that you have about this for the audience. Because I often think what we're trying to do when we're successful is give the audience as close as they can an experience to what it was like for us when we were on location witnessing this. So we're acting through the camera as a kind of a transducer of what we saw and putting it there. And David's job is to help that experience that we had translate into an audience. So it's as if he was there whilst we were watching it and filming it. He's recording, writing down what they saw, this was this, and then how it, and then he just, like a piece of poetry, speaks it out. So that somebody has to be able to have that sensitivity. You have to understand what's going on in animals' minds and what's going on inside their heads. Now, trying to translate what you see and how that animal's behaving so that it connects with what you as a human being understand of the world. And that involves empathy, that involves intensity and perspective. A lot of it's about trying to put yourself through the animal's eyes, both in terms of the storytelling, but also what the camera sees. And getting the camera close to animals, both physically close, but also kind of emotionally close to the animals, is a critical part of what we do. And David is somebody who helps us explain that when he narrates these shows.
I mean, Planet Earth, the kind of brands are very important to BBC Studios and the BBC. Obviously, it operates and is broadcast in lots of countries all around the world. Are you making an international show, or is it a British show because other countries want to see a British execution of it? How do you think about that as a format and as a program you deliver around the world?
I don't think you always ask me that. However, I do think about that myself because, of course, part of my job, because I'm not just the executive producer of the show, I'm also the creative director of the Natural Institute. So part of my job is to make sure that our programs are developed and evolved for an international audience. But I think fundamentally, we make a show for the license fee payer. I mean, that's in our DNA. You know, even though I work now for BBC Studios, whose job is to be a sort of global producer, we are still fundamentally making shows for the British audience. And interestingly enough, the English speaking world, there's something about the British perspective on science and nature which does seem to appeal. There may be commissioners out there in some other companies who are throwing their hands up in horror and saying, what? But I know from speaking to a number of people who are, you know, senior in international broadcasters who say there's something about your way that does translate, especially in the English speaking world. But I think it translates into other parts of the world too. You know, these projects are extraordinarily successful internationally. I can't remember how many countries it is, but I think there's about three countries in the world that didn't transmit it, and that's probably because I don't think they have a transmitter. So, you know, it's seen in pretty much every corner of the world, which is wonderful, because when you go overseas, as we all do, of course, when people, and you're in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and somebody says, I saw that show in a hotel in the center of town or something, rather, you think, yeah. Public service broadcasting reaches wide.
It does. And also it reaches wide from Bristol, which has been a core base of the National History Unit. And I think you're in new digs with Aardman over the road as well.
The Natural History Unit has been in Bristol for 66 years, I think it is. And it's a bit of a quirk of BBC broadcasting history. I mean, most of network programming was always made in London historically. But for some weird reason, the clever people in Bristol managed to steal something or other and set up camp down in Bristol, which has been again, I should be careful what I say, but I think it's been wonderful for us because we kind of get left alone. So always we're seen as a slightly eccentric bunch, which we are to some degree. We're left to our own devices. As long as we keep making these programs, we kind of get left alone. So Bristol became a kind of an epicenter for wildlife filmmaking. And of course, there are now many other people who make these kind of shows who aren't the BBC. There's independents of all colour and stripe, but a lot of them are in a kind of hinterland around, or they're connected anyway to around Bristol. And I think there's a kind of a center of gravity here, which brings in production houses and camera talent and sound talent, all that kind of thing aggregates around Bristol. And we, the NHU, were for many, you know, mostly all of our lives up in White Ladies Road. But then 3 years ago, we moved down to this fancy new premises down in the docks. And it's fantastic. It's a kind of uber eco, low energy environment, and it's
well. That's what you want for the National History Unit.
Yeah. We should be doing that. Funnily enough, I was in those offices for, I say, for 30 odd years, and I thought I would be. They'd have to drag me out. The opposite. I couldn't. I never thought about it again. The new premises. It's something about the infrastructure there is just it's more all open plan. And again, a lot of us thought, oh, really, do we want to be open plan? But actually, it creates a real creative oomph. Real creative hive.
Well, that's great. I mean, this week we've had, as we kind of continually have, there's obviously questions about the BBC license fee and it being connected to below level inflation and the knock on that will have on the corporation. And there is a kind of interesting relationship going forward, isn't there, with BBC Studios and what it does to bring money into the corporation alongside the public service side. Mm. But it's hard to divide the two sometimes. And any cuts aren't great for program makers, are they? Or for the public that want to consume not inexpensive programs like the one that you've just made?
Well, we are, even though, as I say, I now work for BBC Studios, we're very, very tightly bound in sort of historically, but also in terms of our values and our ambitions with public service. Of course, we're still part of the mothership. You know, we're still part of the BBC. So any headwinds that the BBC faces, inevitably we will feel them, and we'll have to deal with them. And one of the things that's always been quite interesting about working in the Natural History Unit, we've always been, for want of a better word, commercial, in the sense that our programmes have always travelled very well internationally, partly, of course, because animals don't speak French, German, Serbo-Croat, whatever. And also, the sorts of stories we tell are kind of culturally agnostic. You know, everybody understands what animals, pretty much what these animals do. So I think we've always had the pressure on us and the ability to fund and bring in resources to make these programs from the international market. Of course, the public service are an important part of that funding, and ultimately they are a commissioner for something like Planet Earth 3. We do have the skills and the experience to make sure that these programs are adequately funded in the future.
And obviously it's not just the show, is it? There's obviously spin-off elements that are used in different places where maybe ad breaks are, but also there's a podcast that accompanies this series as well. Yes. From the Radio 4 team. It's great that it can exist in those places too.
Yeah. Sitting around me, there's a number of us who have been working on it. We just did the last recording of the last episode this morning, actually. And it's really been an interesting thing to do, editorially interesting and creatively interesting. But what I found enjoyable about it is that it's an opportunity to genuinely go behind the scenes, because there's a sort of freedom to be unrestrained or to amble around what we do. And the funny thing is that, you know, of course, we live this every single day of our lives. And so to us, it feels like kind of, well, of course we do this. But actually, when you get a good interviewer starting to talk to you about this, you realize, actually, you know, this is probably, people probably find this quite fascinating. It's a kind of vicarious experience of understanding what it is, what we do. And also, we are human beings. The experience of doing these films is complex. You know, it can be quite challenging at times. It can be wonderfully uplifting, but especially as time goes on, more recent times, as we started to see some of the places we love and have been to from over the years, perhaps not doing as well as they were. Some of the species that we filmed at the beginning of Zorico not doing so well. Others that were in trouble doing better. You know, and it gives us an opportunity to just expand, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say, on some of these things that we think about and we talk about amongst ourselves, but perhaps would only talk amongst ourselves and talk about amongst ourselves. So, yes, it gives an opportunity. It's a vehicle for us to share what we do and how we feel and how we think about what we do to a broad audience. And it seems to be people seem to be liking it. So well, we can do some more.
Normally I say that the pictures are better on the radio, but I think in this case, I'm not entirely sure that's the case. So this obviously sort of comes to an end towards the end of this year into next year. What does 2024 have in store for the units? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm pleased to say we've got a lot of work in the pipeline. It's always nerve-wracking when you look forward. What's the landscape of television? It changes so fast, and it continues to change faster as well. But there does seem to be an appetite for the very best type of programming of this type, and I think there has been quite a lot of it about for over the last few years. And I perhaps some of that is going to fall by the wayside, but there does seem to be, for the very best and for the very particular thing, programs and projects that have something genuinely interesting and new to say about the natural world, there is a real appetite for that. And there are a number of projects that we have to do. The only reason why I'm slightly dodging the question is I can't remember what programs I'm allowed to talk about.
That's fine. We will let you off.
I've got at least four projects, big projects that I'm going to be working on in the future. And actually, there's one with Sir David coming out right at the end of the year, a little passion project of his, which I think you'll all enjoy. One of his great loves is fossils, and it's a fantastic story about a great fossil, a British fossil found on the south coast of Britain.
Well, we look forward to seeing that. Mike, thanks for joining us. That was Mike Gunton. Right, Adam and Rebecca are back for the media quiz, this week entitled Pressed for Time. I have three Fleet Street stories to share with you. The problem is I only have 2 seconds to tell them. So can you unpick my speedy precis and explain the story at length? I love the way they make me do all the hard work. It's best of three, so buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Rebecca, you will say?
Rebecca.
And Adam, you will say?
Adam.
Let's play Pressed for Time. Number one, Dyson Lucy's libel.
Rebecca.
Yes.
So this was essentially a comment piece in The Mirror where they had effectively kind of criticised I don't think actually as robustly, you know, I'm quite surprised it went as far as trial, but essentially Dyson for backing Brexit and then moving his headquarters to Singapore. And they'd sort of said that he'd kind of screwed the country and sort of done a runner. And Dyson sued and lost.
I mean, the line is, the vacuum cleaner tycoon, I'm hoping that they won't come after us now. The vacuum cleaner tycoon who championed vote leave due to the economic opportunities it would bring to British industry before moving his global head office to Singapore. I mean, there's not a lot there, is there?
No, and it's, yeah. And I think that it did say screwed the country or something as well. And they kind of decided that was an opinion. I'm shocked that got as far as court, to be honest, because it just seems such an obvious, like, open and shut, honest opinion case.
I mean, it plays into sort of all the issues around slaps, doesn't it? And this is sort of very rich people wanting to curb some journalism.
Yeah. And I mean, I've definitely been in positions where I've had a story and essentially we've been told, look, you've probably got all the evidence. You should be fine. We can't afford to defend this in court. If they sue, we're not running it, which is utterly depressing when it happens. And yeah, it does feel like it is a little bit about sort of, I don't want to say about a particularly litigious person, but it does, you know, one might think perhaps that it feels a little bit like, yeah, making an example of somebody or hoping they'll just back down and settle and retract it, which they, you know, fair play to them, The Mirror didn't, and they took it to court. And it is expensive to defend these things, even if you win. So fair play.
And it does have that chilling effect, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
If you are worried about these sorts of things, then you don't print slightly dangerous stuff.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like I say, it's happened to me.
Right, question number two. Remember, I might piss Dave Barclays.
Oh, Adam.
Yes.
I mean, I think I heard the word Barclays in there.
Oh, so I didn't even hear the words.
Yeah, is your next job racing commentary? Anyway.
Clearly not. Clearly
yeah,
not.
So this will be the sale of the Telegraph and the Spectator, which has kind of gone through but is now subject to a public intervention notice. I forget the exact term. But so obviously this group, backed with Abu Dhabi money, has paid off the debts that the Barclays had at Lloyd's, which then allows the Barclays to take ownership. But obviously the idea then is that this group then takes over from the Barclays the control of the two papers, and that's where a culture secretary has stepped in and is sort of let's have a long, hard look at this and see if we want Abu Dhabi owning the Telegraph.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that if it sort of goes wrong for Redbird, it's kind of back with the Barclays, who now have the papers that probably aren't worth 1.3 billion and they owe Redbird slash the Abu Dhabi lot all the money.
Yeah, it's really hard to get your head around that
whole
thing. And then
all he gets the Telegraph after all of that as well.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the trouble is that there's been a lot of talk in the media, but everyone is an interested party one way or the other, you know. So the other groups, be that, you know, Murdoch or the Mail Group or I saw even Axel Springer, yeah. You know, was looking, you know, lots of people who would have quite liked it. And it's kind of interesting because the way it was done is that they just went in over the top and you could, you know, this slightly smart deal, we'll just pay off your debts and it doesn't go there, which might have been more than it went for at auction, but might not have been.
Also,
but you get it. You get it.
Yeah.
So, you know, do I do that? Anyway, it's buy it now on eBay, right?
Well, they were hoping to scare off other bidders as well, weren't they? Because they're so invested in having this company, which, yeah, like, it's probably not worth what they're paying for.
But also, like we talked about on the podcast last week, everyone's had a bit of a kick in of Jeff Zucker. But as soon as you become a baron, then you're clear, aren't you? Yeah. They all sort of look after themselves. So we'll see who gets to be the new boss later on. Right, I think that's a point apiece. A final one, new European profit.
Was that the new European is in profit?
Correct. Yes, that's right. The new European is in profit with 33,000 paying readers. We had Matt Kelly on the show a few weeks ago and he was saying it was on the cards. I mean, no mean feat to be successful in the newspaper industry and still from a relatively recent time.
Yeah, I mean, to start a new publication and make, because we did have, I've forgotten the name of it, there was a magazine, a newspaper that the Mirror tried to start a few years ago, wasn't there? And everyone was quite hopeful and it tried and it just didn't get anywhere. So yeah, the fact that this is making profit, which some of the really established titles are not doing at the moment, is brilliant.
And we just show you need a particular tone of voice or you need a certain niche, don't you, to do well in the media.
Yeah, I mean, they carved it out. They went into the sort of, you know, obviously the post-Brexit kind of thing. And they found that area and they're super serving it. Mm. And maybe that's not an area easily filled. You know, broadcaster, there's not really a space in broadcasting and across the wider existing landscape. Yeah, but it's interesting, you know, that a print product like that can still do it. It's great.
Adam, you become our winner. You get to take the Media Podcast to launch a new spin-off newspaper title and to turn it into profit as well. So if you can sort that out, that'd
brilliant.
Be great. My thanks to you, Adam, and to you, Rebecca. Rebecca, where can people keep up with your work?
You can find me on broadcastnow.co.uk and on Twitter or X at Rebecca K. Cooney.
Adam?
AdamBowie.com or at Adam Bowie on Threads these days.
Lovely. Thank you both. And that's it from us today at the London Podcast Studios. Remember, you can get 25% off your first booking at this lovely place when you use the code MEDIAPOD. That's at thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off. And if you're new to the show, why not hit follow and get us in your ears all year round? And whilst you're there, why not share the show with your friends and tell them that they too should listen to all this media goodness every week. My name is Matt Deegan. The producers were Ollie Pitt and Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.